Welcome to the ICA for a discussion between two writers about literature and politics in the wake of 9/11. Martin Amis scarcely needs any introduction as one of Britain's greatest living novelists, author of 12 novels, 6 works of non-fiction, and his latest novel, House of Meetings, was published last year to great critical acclaim, and newly published this week in paperback by Jonathan Cape. Andrew Anthony is a features journalist on The Observer, author of a book published last month called The Fallout, which is a book about the direction taken by the contemporary British liberal left, which Andrew disagrees with. But the reason why both of our writers are here this evening is because both, in different ways, have taken a controversial stand about violent Islamic extremism, and perhaps more pertinently, the danger, or they believe, of the capitulation of the West and perhaps Western society more generally in the face of it. So they've come here to defend the stands that they've taken, to talk a little bit perhaps about the reaction to those, and most importantly, to defend their thesis in the face of you, the audience. So we start off the conversation between Andrew and Martin. Then we throw the discussion open to the audience. And then we aim to finish at about 8 o'clock. At 8 o'clock, Martin and Andrew have kindly agreed to remain around for a while in the ICA bookshop to sign some copies of their books, House of Meetings and The Fallout. So please refrain from mobbing or assaulting them on their way out. Join them in the ICA bookshop and buy some copies of their books if all of us are still talking to each other afterwards. Andrew.
Hi, good evening. As this is ostensibly a discussion about literature and radical Islam, before I get on to my 9/11 experience, I want to talk about a book about radical Islam by an Islamist. Just recently, I was reading Milestones, which, as many of you may know, is a book by Saeed Qutb, who equally many of you may know was one of the founding fathers of 20th century Islamism. He was executed in Egypt by Nasser in the 60s. But while he was in prison, he wrote this book, Milestones. And I've tried to read Milestones a couple of times because, you know, it's an important text of our times in a way. And again, I was trying just recently, and I kept coming up against this repeating phrase in the book, which is that the only way to freedom is through complete submission to God's will. And I wondered, it reminded me of something, and I couldn't think what it was, and then it came to me. Now, Saeed Qutb was a morally anxious man, to say the least, especially about sexual morals, and he wouldn't have appreciated the comparison. But I realized what it reminded me of was one of those kind of S&M enthusiasts who tell you that you know, the way to true liberty is to be bound up in a rubber suit with straws up your nostrils, and that's the only way to really achieve freedom. And of course, you know, it's one person's choice of freedom, but the difference between the S&M enthusiast, unfortunately, and the Islamist is that the S&M enthusiast restricts his interest to the basements, to a Soho basement. And unfortunately, Islamism has a slightly more global ambition than that. Now, as it happened on 9/11, or September 11th, as I should say, 2001, I was in a Soho basement. I hasten to add, it wasn't that kind of establishment, but it was in a room much like this. It was actually a screening room for films. And I was reviewing films, and I was watching a film, and suddenly, at the end, an image of two towers, one of them a light flickered onto the screen. And I thought at first it was one of those pieces of radical advertising in which some familiar image was transformed in some transgressive way. And it took me a while to adjust to the reality that these two buildings had been attacked. And in fact, it's taken a long time to adjust to the reality of living in the post-9/11 world. And initially, one of the few things I could be sure of was to reject those people who came instantly to a kind of rationalization of what had gone on and straight away saw this attack on America as a cry of the oppressed against Western imperialism. It was, Luke Skywalker up against the Death Star all over again. And, I thought about this and really what they were saying is that, yes, these people may take the subjective form of religious maniacs, but objectively, they're third world freedom fighters. Well, they didn't seem like freedom fighters to me. It didn't seem like a freedom that was worth fighting for. But this rational urge to rationalize also was not just restricted to the cause. It was also of the effect. Recently, for example, I was discussing my book at another meeting, and a number of people pointed out that really, when it came down to it, 9/11 wasn't any big deal. 3,000 people died. What's that? Many more people die in car accidents. And it was a means of sanitizing 9/11, a means of absorbing it, making it comfortable for us so it wasn't too awkward to think about. But the truth is, it was a meticulously planned successful attempt, to kill as many people, as many civilians as possible. And I think it was an utterly unprovoked attack. I think it was a crime against humanity. Now, since then, the world has changed in many ways. We've had the Iraq War, which has cast a long shadow backwards over 9/11. But the fact remains that that is what 9/11 was about initially. And I think it's, if we're talking about the duty of writers in the post-9/11 age, is at least to acknowledge what took place and not to pretend it was something else.
Right. I wrote about September the 11th on, I think, September the 18th, and in common with every other writer on earth, what I was doing was playing for time. What I remember feeling was a complete, utter sense of impotence, as if nothing I could ever say would have any effect ever again, that everything I'd already written, that, the list on the title, opposite the title page that says by the same author, that you used to smugly consult as a kind of staccato autobiography, now looked like gibberish, and also insultingly and ridiculously, the last book on the list was a book called The War Against Cliché. And I thought, well, we can live with, the searing heat and the, chilling, bone-chilling cold and all the rest of it, and we can live with cliché, but now we have to live with war. Then I felt, as I wrote later, there's a marvelous and ridiculous Kafka story called Josephine, or The Mouse People, and it's about an opera singing mouse. she sings opera in the mouse world for a living, and at one point she begins to have severe doubts about her voice, that it's losing some of its operatic resonance. And she goes on stage and performing in front of thousands of other mice. She starts to sing, and one of the other mice in the audience turns to another mouse and says, sing. She can't even squeak. And that's exactly how I felt. I couldn't even squeak. But as was tolerantly observed, acknowledged by many journalists, an unusual number of novelists chose to write about September the 11th, and that was because they couldn't write about anything else. They were mute. The study felt like a sort of soundproof box or a sense deprivation unit. I had not lived through an event of anything like this magnitude. One of the reasons why it's ridiculous to call this day 9/11 is that 9/11, by our system, calendric system or notation, refers to the day that the Berlin Wall came down, which was on November the 9th, 1989. It's as if Clio, the muse of history, had put this date as a kind of time bomb joke about our ridiculous adoption of the pallid and blithe Americanism that has chosen to call this date 9/11. That means November the 9th over here. And you see in the same piece, you know, the 21-7 trial after 9/11. You know, it's the wrong way around. And the pathetic contrivance of 7/7 kept the whole thing going because it meant both. Anyway, the Berlin Wall, I lived through that, the fall of the Berlin Wall, but that wasn't a tremendous event. The end of what has been called the Long War before this was called the Long War, beginning in 1917 and going on till 1989. And after 1949, a nuclear conflict in the mind, as Eric Hobsbawm has called it, the contest of nightmares that completely dominated my life up till that date. But September the 11th had, over November the 9th, this peculiarity that its suddenness, its absolute blinding, dazzling suddenness, and its brilliance, its demonic brilliance, the idea of using a passenger airliner as a missile, stunning paradigm shift. I mean, the Berlin Wall had been looking like it was going to collapse any moment, but no one had nearly crashed four airplanes into America of set purpose. So although perhaps it will turn out to be a less significant event, its suddenness, its drama, made it a different order of experience for those who lived through it. I wrote this piece in the week after that event, and I looked at it the other day, and it had a kind of hallucinatory quality. It was fevered by shock and rumor. I've looked at a couple of books recently that went to press, and they added quickly one on the Taliban where they added an introduction, you know, post 9/11, just sort of slung on. And the writer was saying there were 7,000 dead. In that week, it wasn't clear how many were dead. My wife's sister was taking her children to school and just dropped them off and was coming back, and she saw the second plane go in. And when the children returned from school, which they did very suddenly, they were on 11th Street, which leads to St. Vincent's Hospital, and there's a queue of blood donors all the way down the street. And my nephew and niece were out there with trays of cold drinks to offer these people, and none of them was needed because they expected a massive influx of the injured, and there weren't any injured. They were all dead. We later learned that it was 3,000, and that was well below what we all expected. So the response was was full of rumor, too. By that time, a week later, the television, when you dared to turn it on, showed you Americans queuing up not to give blood, but for anthrax hose downs. The paper, when you dared open it, showed you what anthrax could do if weaponized anthrax disseminated through a society, what the results of that would be. And I think I'm not alone in saying that I was 52 when this happened. But I was thinking, you know, I have five children. I was thinking, I've had my life, and that's fine. But what kind of future awaits my children? And knowing that this was an event that would significantly worsen their lives. And that took a while to absorb. In the original piece, I made the first, you know, Andrew's already referred to it, the first reflex of a Western mind, which is to look for the reason for this. You know, people don't do this for no reason. We're in the habit of investigating ourselves for the crimes of the past and so on. And in the piece, I said, you know, do we realize that we're responsible for the deaths of a million children in Iraq through our sanctions, listing other Western crimes and so on. It actually, this tendency has been labeled as rationalist naivety by Paul Berman, an American writer who's been consistently very good on this subject. And it's what you reach for because it's how your mind works. But it doesn't apply. It is not a tit-for-tat. It is not, as I said to Eric Hobsbawm, it's not business as usual, is it? And he said, no, it's not business as usual. Eric Hobsbawm, very anti-American, very anti-Israel, etc. It's not business as usual. This is something, you know, if we can't identify Islamism as a completely poisonous death cult, with its tenets, let me list them, racist, misogynist, homophobic, totalitarian, inquisitional, imperialist, and genocidal. If we can't spot an enemy there, then, you know, particularly with the 20th century so fresh in our mind, and the death cults, by which I mean an armed doctrine that radically reduces the value of human life. And we've seen it in Bolshevism and Stalinism and in Maoism, where, you know, as Trotsky said, we must get rid of this papist Quaker babble about the sanctity of human life. We've seen that. We've seen how it works. We've seen how the acceptance of a lowered value for the human life and how a rejection of reason is tremendously liberating at first. It gives the death cult its escape velocity. So the first imaginative task was to say this is not a retributive action by wronged people, and the secondary task, which, you know, is not over for me, is to imagine what it would be really like to truly believe that by besplattering yourself in some bus or street corner, by using your own organs to smear your argument over those all around, that you would then, before the moment of death, you don't even have to die, you're transported to this vulgar paradise with its fountains of white wine, which neither befuddle the head nor give you a hangover, and the ridiculous business about the virgins and all the rest of it. What sort of effort do you have to make to imagine that? And if you give it a try, it's then that you see the nature of the force ranged against us.
That's a pretty compelling argument, I think. But obviously, a lot of people are concerned about how America's reacted to to 9/11?
Well, I think, I mean, the principle that is now emerging at the think tank level is that the danger of terrorism is not what it inflicts. The 3,000 dead, the hideous scenes in New York was recoverable from within a matter of days. You know, the economy wobbled and all that. But it's not what it inflicts. That can't harm the West. What the danger is what it provokes. And the Iraq War is by far, by many magnitudes, the gravest result of September the 11th. And to look at it from a great distance, almost an inhuman distance, you could see the attack of September the 11th as a provocation, classic provocation. And the so-called cakewalk into Baghdad as a feint, you know, to get them in there. Baghdad, the third holiest city in Islam. This will keep the fires burning for a generation. Osama bin Laden said just after the attacks that he expected America to embroil itself in a war in an Islamic country. He meant Afghanistan. He didn't think that America would make the additional gamble of Iraq. And in fact, it's Henry Kissinger whom we must thank for Iraq, because it was he that Bush listened to, and his doctrine was Afghanistan is not enough. I think everyone here thinks that Afghanistan would have been enough, that to have created a shining model in Afghanistan with nation building and all the rest. I mean, as it is, the population of Afghanistan has increased by about the amount that the population of Iraq has decreased. It's gone up by 25%. Something like 4 million Afghanis have come back to Afghanistan. And that is, in these sort of situations, that is the most compelling argument for the justice and you know,
but
rightness.
There were plenty of people in the West who, it wasn't a question of Afghanistan is not enough. They felt that Afghanistan was too much. There's a kind of default pacifism in the face of any kind of threat, which is to look inwards and say, you know, it's our fault in some way. You know, let's not compound the problem. And I slightly disagree with you when you say that 9/11 was recoverable from, in the sense that you know, it needn't have an effect on us. But I think 9/11.
It's not going to bring us down.
No, it doesn't. It certainly won't instantly, or you know, or even in the midterm. But I think it starts a process in which you have to address what you believe in. You know, and I think a lot of liberals in the West are not really sure whether they truly do believe in liberal democracy. They feel uncomfortable about you know, proclaiming that in any way, asserting it. It seems as if it's a kind of superior position to take up. But you know, it strikes me that, you know, you don't have to be an evangelist. You don't have to go around invading countries. But the first responsibility is to acknowledge that, you know, the wealth of opportunity and benefits that liberal democracy brings, and the poverty of those things that are available in which societies that don't have liberal democracy. Now, one of the things that's often said about the sort of post 9/11, you know, resistance is that it stems from American imperialism. But the problem in the Middle East, well, you know, it's not really about American imperialism. It's really about the fact that, for example, in the whole of the Arab world, has translated fewer books in its history than Spain translates in 1 year. There, you know, there needs to be free inquiry. There needs to be free debate. You can't, of course, the problem is you can't force that on people. But one of the things you can do, in the West at least, is to start off by acknowledging the benefits of it here and being, you know, very resilient about maintaining those things. And I think in the post 9/11 era, there has been a kind of discomfort about announcing those things. And we've seen various occasions in which I can think of the murder of Theo van Gogh, whose famous last words were, "Can't we just talk about this?" And the response to Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who I saw speak here a couple of years ago, which was one of almost embarrassment amongst the liberal West. You know, why does she have to go on about these things? Why does she have to embarrass us with bringing attention to these differences? And I think the key moment for me was the Danish cartoons, which is, you know, not about literature, it's about some scrawled images. Now, those cartoons were first published in Denmark in a newspaper which I'm pretty sure most of us here never have heard of, Jyllands-Posten. It took 6 months before they became an international subject of debate and fevered argument. But when they did, they became a global story. Embassies were set alight. People died. People argued. But we in this country were not allowed to see these cartoons. We who, you know, with a press that must be the most intolerant, unrestrained press there is, suddenly developed restraint and tolerance. But of course, it wasn't restraint and tolerance. It was fear. It was fear that there may be some blowback, that people would target newspapers. And I think this is one of the responses that I think we need to kind of untangle. I think there is a kind of response of fear that we have to overcome. There's a response of guilt, i.e. it's our fault. Whatever it is, it's our fault. And deep down, somewhere, there's a kind of sneaking respect. These guys are prepared to kill themselves. Anyone who's prepared to kill themselves, surely, you know, that's a cause that we need to take seriously. That's, you know, that's the level of oppression they're placed under, that they're prepared to kill themselves.
And they only do it because they're desperate.
Yeah.
That's rationalist naivety. You know, they blow themselves up because they're desperate. As Ken Livingstone said, that's what people use in an unfair balance. They haven't got F-15s, F-16s, so they use their own bodies. And there's even a little drip of a poem that said the same thing around the same time, I remember. Question to the mayor, would he like them to have F-16s? And it's a tactic that has been used elsewhere, but by the Tamil Tigers who are in Sri Lanka, who were secular, and by Japan in World War II. It's not an entirely new thing. I discovered what martyr really meant the other day, and it was by looking at a photograph, an absolutely astounding photograph of an 18-year-old girl called Zoya Kosmodenskaya, who was strung up and mutilated by the Nazis in a village in Russia in 1941-42 for arson. She was partisan. And this is the most amazing photograph you'll ever see. She's got a taut rope around her neck, although she's been cut down. And one of her breasts has been hacked off, 18-year-old Jewess, very beautiful. And the expression on her face is a true martyr's face, in complete effortless indifference to what has happened to her. Martyr means witness. And that's what martyr means, that you are a witness to your own death, you're being killed for your beliefs, you're a witness to your own death, but that's the extent of your involvement. You are not, it doesn't touch you. Now, the suicide bomber who besplatters himself is not the witness to anything. It's a paltry spiritual act. It signifies nothing, and it's done for vulgar gain. Martyrdom operations, it's the most disgusting sophistry. And at a certain point, in 2005, there were more suicide bombings in Iraq in a month than there were during the whole of the Second Intifada. It was debauched, the whole doctrine of suicide bombing. And these idiots from the Middle East were staggering into Iraq and being strapped up like pieces of ordnance and sent out to obliterate themselves the same day. Talking about how the West has become so nervous about making a judgment about anything at all, unable to identify anything that's clearly malum per se, ill in itself, bad in itself. I want to put this question to you. Do you feel morally superior to the Taliban? Hands up who does. That's not a bad showing. That's about 30%, I'd say. Well, I feel morally superior to the Taliban. The Taliban, do you not feel morally superior to people who, at a stroke at the fall of Kabul in 1996, dismantled the health and the education system of their country by banning women from work? That's a pretty good beginning to a regime. No more health, no more education. Not satisfied with getting women off the street, they consigned them to houses where they blacked up the windows so that not even sunlight got through to them, so that they couldn't be seen. The Taliban, who have had many a two-day massacre of the Hazaras and other sects and other ethnicities within Afghanistan, who in their massacres take the trouble to slaughter all the animals, you don't feel morally superior to that. The trouble is, in the West, now, watch this. The wonder of the cigarette.
It's your Sharon Stone moment.
The trouble with us in the West is that we've become... we've succumbed to a pious paralysis where we can't even say that we're superior to the Taliban. Why can't we? It makes it much easier if we think of it in this way, that we're not making a judgment about another ethnicity, about people with darker skins than ourselves. We're making a judgment that is not geographical, but chronological. What was America like 100 years ago? Armed gangs in the streets, lynchings of black people in the street. To take a much more immediate and striking example, in 1968, there was the My Lai massacre, where in one of the most disgusting slaughters in history, American troops submitted to a kind of frenzy and killed 500 or 600 civilians in Vietnam. Many women and children, with all the usual things of slicing off breasts, bayonets up vaginas, everything that you've ever read about in the annals of ferocity. In America, a country song called The Battle Hymn of William J. Kelly sold 1 million copies in a week. Congress applauded when Kelly's sentence was commuted from 10 years hard labor to 1 year of house arrest. Public opinion vastly on the side of the soldiers. This is a massacre of 600 people. That was 1968. Compare it to Abu Ghraib. Where is the country song in praise of Lindy England? Where is congressional support for the torturers of Abu Ghraib? Abu Ghraib, a tiny crime compared to My Lai, and yet our revulsion was utterly unanimous. That's how much the West has come on in 40 years. when we feel morally superior to the Taliban, we're doing the simple and humble task of feeling morally superior to the 13th century, and I think we can all afford to do that.
We're acknowledging progress. I mean, that, you know, if humanity is not about progress, well, then what's it? You know, what's the point? You have to attempt progress, and that's what you're acknowledging there. Now, I think what a lot of people have difficulty with is that in any way isolating Islamism for you know, particular attention or criticism, it's in some way seen as being Islamophobic. That, you know, we're a diverse, multiracial, multi-ethnic society, and that in some way we are pinpointing and discriminating against Muslims in general. Now, I really think that that's, you know, that's an argument that we have to have out in the open. We have to be able to say, no, this is not the case. People can believe whatever they believe in. It's their actions that count. And, you know, if people are calling for women to be second-class citizens, if people are calling for gays to be thrown off of buildings, we shouldn't feel any anxiety about saying that we disagree with this. This is wrong. This is not what the this is not what progress is about. And I think, you know, deep in our kind of liberal hearts, we're not quite sure if we're allowed to say that. But
when we slightly weary of finding out what they want to do to Jews and Crusaders, the pure Islamists, then we can divert ourselves by finding out what they want to do to Hindus and to Buddhists and to every other form of religious belief, and what they want to do among themselves too. And the Al-Qaeda-ism, which is perhaps the best name for it, is also exterminatory with regard to the Shia, who are hypocrites and apostates, and they want to kill all them too. The doctrine refined by Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama's number two, is known as takfir. It's an ancient heresy, some might say, or a tinker toy sophistry. And it runs like this, that, you know, when they slaughtered all those people, managing to get the odd American in among them in Northeast Africa in, when was it, 2000 or 2000,
you know, in 98.
98. 500 blindings in Nairobi with flying glass. The doctrine of takfir came to their aid, and by this doctrine, you can kill absolutely everyone, anyone and everyone, because if you kill infidels, they were going to go to hell anyway, so what's the difference? And if you kill good Muslims, they were going to go to heaven anyway, so what does it matter? You don't need great moral exertion to see something amiss there, I think.
I think the most striking case for me was what happened after the events of the 7th of July, not 7-7, in which you had British magazines, the Statesman, for example, saying that these were Blair's bombs. They weren't the responsibility of the people who strapped them to their backs and sat down next to commuters and set them off. No, that wasn't them. It wasn't the responsibility of the people who encouraged them to do it. No, it wasn't that. It was Blair's bombs.
By the way, I think is the most... The idea that he's opened us up to terrorist attack.
Yeah.
I want to be open to terrorist attack. There are no Switzerland positions here. There are no neutralist positions.
Yeah. Here's something. I want to read you something that John Pilger wrote after the Madrid bombings in which 200 people were slaughtered. Again, without warning, although there weren't suicide bombings on this occasion. The current threat of attacks in countries whose governments have close alliances with Washington is the latest stage in a long struggle against the empires of the West, their rapacious crusades and domination. The motivation of those who plant bombs in railway carriages derives directly from this truth. It's as if, you know, what they were, you know, paying back for the Viet Cong. Here's one for the Sandinistas. You know, that's nonsense. This had nothing to do with American crusades. You know, a lot of this comes from Saudi Arabia, which has been exporting, its Wahhabist creed in what is a flagrant case of cultural imperialism, spending a lot of money exporting this idea.
With American help, it has to be said.
Yes, it's true. And there are all manner of contradictions here. You know, it's like people, you know, often say, oh, America, they created Osama in Afghanistan. You know, it has to be America's fault. America, you know. Well, I mean, the situation in Saudi Arabia is that you have a venal, corrupt government, which is allied to a very extreme Puritan kind of religious clerical order. And the opposition is even more extreme. And that's the situation in Saudi Arabia. That's what the world is dealing with, you know. We're sitting here under electricity. We'll leave and drive in cars, you know. There is a way that we say, look, let's renounce all this comfort. Let's renounce this modernity that we've created. Oil is just a really sick Western idea. Let's leave it. But the fact is, you know, the reality is the world has to deal with Saudi Arabia. I mean, I'm not sure what America is supposed to do about Saudi Arabia. I think the British government, the corruption that's been involved in, I think the Americans, I think it's appalling and embarrassing. But the fact remains, you have a situation where you have a bunch of extremists running that country, and the opposition is far more extreme. And there's no easy answer to that.
Yes, and it's not, you know, the blanket accusation is that we support all the vilest regimes in the Islamic world. And we supported Saddam for a while, and we're all meant to feel absolutely lousy about that. But the reason he was supported was because the alternative would have been victory for a rampant Iran and the pan-Shia crescent through the whole of the Middle East. I mean, these are the kind of decisions that are taken at what is called realpolitik, you know, the lesser of various evils, the least of various evils. I think Iran is a kind of an example that we should look at. If these American Western-sponsored regimes are so intolerable, do what Iran did. Have a revolution about it. And that's what Iran did in 1979, and spontaneously constructed an absolutely vile regime of theocratic terror without any nudging from the West. You know, that's what they ended up with. Can I look for a moment at the character of Osama bin Laden, who is the sort of Che Guevara of the current wave, in that he has done very little except be the poster boy for this armed doctrine. The core of his appeal in the Islamic world is that he is struck back against the Americans, but that he is also ascetic, that he's lived in a cave, that he drinks contaminated water, that he suffered. This is very much a part of his myth. Now, you know, Ayman al-Zawahiri and the whole Taliban regime are among the most damaged individuals in leadership positions on earth. The president, Mullah Omar, the the Minister of the Interior and the Minister of Justice in Afghanistan at one time all had one eye. If you look at his... Look at Zama's...
The land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
Yeah. All, Zama's surrounded by tin-legged zealots and, you know, amputee mullahs, and they're all in half, these, they're all in bits, these people. Zama, you know, a very stupid man, I think, unusually low IQ, did at least have the wit to stay in one piece. But if you look at his intellectual development... As late as 1985, he's saying they're stealing our oil to pay the Jews to kill our brothers. If ever you see an American, he said, in words dripping with menace, you should notify him of our grievances and write to U.S. embassies. This was in 85 or something. Write to U.S. embassies. You know, within 10 years, he was blowing them up. Ayman al-Zawahiri was tortured in Egypt, like Said Qutb. And there's quite a vigorous case to be made for the fact that IT, as they call it, international terrorism, as they sinisterly call it, was created in the prisons of the Middle East. But Osama has no such excuse. He went from writing to American embassies to takfir, killing everyone, because he saw that this was what was playing. This was what had political appeal. This was the direction he took. I think the great trauma, the great unacknowledged trauma of Islam is Israel, the little Satan, as it's known in the Middle East. Now, in 1948... Israel, a country that occupies 0.6 of Arab lands, defeated the armies of Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, plus the supplementary forces of Iraq, Lebanon, and Saudi Arabia. Geographically, this would be like America being defeated by New Jersey. Now, that's bad enough. You know, that's a reverse that any regime or ideology would have to take on board. What does it mean to people who passionately believe that God is attentive to all their desires and deserts? I think this was a negative eureka of massive proportions for the Islamic idea. In the days of Islamic ascendancy, you know, the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, the philosophical justification for the spread of Islam was the argument from manifest success, that, you know, it's patent that God is on our side, because look at these enormous victories he's granting us. That all ended perhaps the 17th century, perhaps the 18th century, and 300 years of manifest failure have followed. Then Israel, in 1948, without any superpower assisting them, defeated all this pan-Islamic army. A rethink is called for when something like that happens. And it's 1948 was when Said Qutb set sail for America and had his traumatic time in Greeley, Colorado, where, as he wrote, he joins a club very rashly, and from his description of it, this is in the book Milestones, which is known as the Mein Kampf of Islamism, he joins a club very rashly in Greeley, Colorado, a town, by the way, that was dry, and he goes to an occasion of this club, and he says, breast touches breast, lip touches lip, and the air is full of lust. And what he's describing is a church hop, a soft drink church hop. That's how terrified he is of sexuality. And this is another great theme, you know, that it's... what they fear about modernity, and it's not the usual things they list. It's sexual equality. Paralyzingly horrific to an Islamist, because there's been no political power for centuries, and now even the patriarchal power. And what is God, as George Bush put it, but that greater father in the sky, you know, patriarchal system fossilized over centuries, if it can't even guarantee you authority in your own home. I think that Islam is a religion that's having a nervous breakdown, basically, and it's painted itself into a corner vis-a-vis modernity. You know, we talk about great Islamic art and the curlicues and all the corner painting. That is the great Islamic art, and that's the corner they've painted themselves into.
I think at this stage it might be a good idea to throw things open to the audience for questions.